It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the opioid epidemic has claimed a growing number of lives, and our guest wants to put a human face on the statistics. We'll find out about an online memorial coming up.
First, deferred action for childhood arrivals, or DACA, made headlines this week when it was reported that President Trump would end the Obama-era program as early as today.
However, the White House has pushed back, saying no decision had been made. We've been hearing this afternoon that a decision is expected now on Tuesday. Today, President Trump addressed the issue while talking with reporters at a meeting with faith leaders. Here's the president.
Sometime today or over the weekend, we'll have a decision. We love the Dreamers. We love everybody.
The program faces a legal challenge from Texas and nine other states. Those states have threatened court action in an attempt to block it unless the president rescinds DACA by September 5th.
Maria Sacchetti is an immigration reporter for The Washington Post, and she's with us now to look at what might be ahead for DACA in the coming days. Maria, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what do we know so far about a potential decision by the president to end the DACA program?
Well, it's just filled with rumors right now. We don't know what's going to happen. What we know is that people are terrified and that there is a lot at stake. Thousands of students with jobs, hundreds of thousands of students with jobs, people who help support their families, people who are terrified now of being deported. There's a lot of states that don't offer in-state tuition to undocumented students. So there are people graduating right now who had really taken for granted that they would be able to study and now are experiencing the shock and fear of the possibility that they won't be able to do that.
Now, the White House has said there is no decision. On the other hand, there's this deadline from 10 conservative states saying we want an answer by Tuesday. So is there an answer, do you think, expected today or in the next couple of days?
I mean, I think we all have been hearing every single day that there might be a decision. You know, you're hearing it from advocates, and there's rumors. And a few weeks ago, I was in Congress when then Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly was saying that he was telling members of Congress that it wasn't clear that DACA would survive a court challenge. And Texas told us yesterday that they are still planning, Texas and the other states that are threatening to sue are still planning to hold the White House to that deadline, that September 5th deadline. And some are fairly certain, it seems like most people are fairly certain that the judge would enjoin DACA, but it's not clear. You know, this program has been going on for 5 years, and it's become its own institution in a way. It's a fragile one for sure, but it's just really not clear what's going to happen. And people, I think, are preparing for the worst. And members of Congress are looking at bills that they could try to pass, but they haven't been able to pass them before. So I think the one true thing is that the students are definitely in limbo, even with DACA right now.
You mentioned some possible alternate legislation in Congress. I know that there are some moderate Republicans who have set up kind of a conservative version of DACA or put that out there as an idea. Is there support for that kind of bill in the Senate and the House?
Well, I mean, that also is not clear. They're certainly trying to build support for it, and I think some people feel that having the Trump administration rescind DACA might lead to that, and it kind of force Congress to act, especially because even among some hardliners, and even among some some Republicans, I mean, there's a lot of sympathy for students with DACA. I mean, they didn't make the choice to come here or stay here illegally, and they've basically, many of them have been raised as Americans. But that said, the Dream Act had been pending before, right? So before DACA, and the House, just wouldn't take it up. They wouldn't you know, it was part of the Senate immigration bill passed in 2013, a bipartisan bill, and it just, you know, the House wouldn't take it up. So it's just really, I guess there's certainly hope for something, but it's not clear what will happen. And some people are speculating that it will be, you know, a bargaining chip, you know, so that President Trump gets funding for the wall and other things he wants to do on immigration. But hard to know.
And DACA, it was never intended to be a permanent fix, but it has been remarkably successful. Has that ended up in a way working against it?
How do you mean?
In the fact that it has had such a broad buy-in from Dreamers that maybe it's become even more unpopular with Republicans who oppose it.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure. I mean, from what we hear, it's that members of Congress and other Republicans are frustrated. They feel that President Obama, sidestepped them and created his sort of own immigration program. Now, others strenuously disagree. They feel that he was fully within his rights to do that. And, of course, the Supreme Court ultimately deadlocked 4-4. And now, you know, President Trump appoints the members of the Supreme Court. So it's you know, it will be hard to know. I mean, I think for a lot of Dreamers who felt safe with DACA, you know, they knew that it was just a Band-Aid solution. But now I think they're fully realizing how tenuous their hold was.
Well, and the Dreamers you're talking about, to be part of this program, they had to give their names, their identifying information to the federal government. Is that something now that could make them more vulnerable to deportation?
Well, I think yes. I mean, anytime you disclose, you know, yourself to the government, that's the case. I mean, that, you know, the government still says that, you know, deporting criminals is a priority. But, you know, if you're driving down the street and you have a broken taillight and someone determines that, you know, you're also not here illegally, then you can be very easily picked up that way. So.
We're talking to Maria Sacchetti right now, immigration reporter for The Washington Post. She's telling us what's ahead possibly for the DACA program in this country. And in terms of what President Trump has said, he said at one point that he would make a decision with great heart, implying that there would be maybe some leniency there toward this program. But what do we know about where he stands on this today?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure we know anything. I mean, you know, he's gone back and forth, you know, and he's gone back and forth even, and you know, beyond the Dreamers. You know, he's after he was elected, he was talking about undocumented immigrants, and he referred to some of them as terrific people, you know, and they would deport criminals first, and they would make a determination about the rest later. But as we've seen, you know, the fastest, even though they are arresting mostly criminals, we don't know what level of criminal they are, whether they're small, you know, misdemeanors or serious crimes. And the fastest growing group of people arrested are people who have no criminal records. So, you know, I guess my understanding is that it's a tug of war inside the White House, and you know, that there's people who sympathize very much, and other people who say, you know, this should not, program should not exist, and that it should, you know, it should be rescinded. So, and what President Trump said is it will be my decision, and that's what we're waiting for.
And to play this out a little bit, if the president does decide he wants to rescind that executive order from the Obama administration, what happens next? Do we look for comprehensive immigration reform, or do we look for maybe a different version of DACA, maybe from Republicans in Congress?
I mean, you know, there are bills pending right now, but we just don't. I think we just don't know. You know, President Trump has his agenda, and it has been to restrict legal and illegal immigration. So, and that's what he's been doing, right? I mean, we've seen the executive orders, we've seen the changes to the immigration system. I mean, it's all, and there's more going on behind the scenes. But I think he's been very upfront about what he's doing. You know, it's created a lot of consternation nationwide, a lot of dramatic moments, and this is the latest one.
And Maria, as someone who covers immigration, what have you seen about how Dreamers and programs that support them, how are they preparing for a pending decision?
you know, I mean, people are marching, they're lobbying, they're trying to, they're supporting one another, they're counseling one another. I think there's all kinds of things going on right now.
Thank you so much for joining us.
All right, take care.
Maria Sacchetti is the immigration reporter for the Washington Post, and she was with us to talk about the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program as the White House decides its fate.
People in all parts of Wisconsin and the nation have been affected by widespread addiction to opioid drugs, including prescription pain medications, illegal drugs like heroin, and newer drugs like the illegal synthetic drugs, including fentanyl.
The national death toll is in the tens of thousands each year, and the overdose death rate in Wisconsin has doubled over the past decade. Our next guest says it's important to get the best possible data on the opioid epidemic, but he also wants to look at the human stories behind the numbers. He's created an online memorial map where people can share the stories of loved ones lost to opioids.
Jeremiah Lindemann joins us now. He's a public interest technology fellow with New America and a geospatial analyst with Esri. He created the map project celebrating lost loved ones to the opioid epidemic. We have a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Jeremiah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, Jeremiah, the death toll from opioid drugs is alarming as it is, but you've written recently that we may be undercounting the number of opioid-related deaths. Why is that?
For several reasons. I think there's cases where I think autopsies are not done in time, and if the drugs leave the system, the toxicology report may not be high enough. To be considered an overdose, the toxicology has to be at a certain level. So if there's a trace of opiate, maybe it was a contributing factor, but it wasn't officially flagged an overdose death. And there's a whole umbrella of other incidents that might have happened between suicides or car accidents, and maybe people are under the influence of these drugs that are being basically labeled as other incidents. And there's also been reports of like rural counties where county coroners are running out of funds to do the toxicology reports. So it's kind of a wild card as to how they're being recorded.
We'll get more into some of the data, but I want to get into this celebrating lost loved ones map. What led you to start this project?
My brother. So I lost my little brother, JT. It's coming up on 10 years ago. JT was a very instrumental part of my life. He was the best man at my wedding, and we had a lot of great times together growing up. Being 10 years ago, I didn't talk about it for a long time, just like many people. It's hard to talk about. You lost someone so young, and maybe the cause is because people aren't really open to talking about the subject. But the more I saw on the news, as the epidemic grew and grew, I realized that JT wasn't really alone, that this was kind of a growing epidemic. And in order for people to understand it and talk about it, which is really the first step to drive change, they have to understand it. And the best way you can do that is to, you know, tell human stories and make a correlation between that. Really wanted to highlight the great people that are dying and that it really is affecting all walks of life.
I'm sorry, 10 years later, for the loss of your brother. And as you say, he wasn't alone. Your family isn't alone. Talk about the people who have been sharing their stories. It's this interactive map, and the impact is very strong, very profound. Can you tell us what we see when we go onto the map?
So when you open the map, there's kind of two parts. There's an interactive map where you can pan and zoom around, and then there's also a link to all the dots on the map of pictures. There's over 1,150 people as of this morning that have added their loved one to this map. You can click on each picture and get a biography. Some people keep it really short. Some people go in depth about maybe perhaps their struggles or simply just what a great person they were and, you know, what a void is left in their life of missing them. So it's pretty impactful in seeing, you know, all these thousands of people that you can just kind of scroll through and pictures. It's a story map that just combines multimedia, the pictures and the map together, so people can see what's happening near me, but also the human element.
Now, when we talk about this here in Wisconsin, a lot of people have been affected by opioids here. If people listening wanted to share their story, can they? How do they do that?
Yeah, so when you go to the website, there's a button to say add lost loved one, and just upload a photo and click on the map to add a location or address and type in a little bio. So it's a really easy process. I have a Facebook page called Celebrating Lost Loved Ones. I also have a Twitter handle at RX Heroin Maps. That's how the map has really gotten out there a lot, is just through social media.
And we have a link to this on the Central Time Facebook page and at WPR.org. If I can, I copied over a few of the stories. I'll read a couple. They're just heartbreaking. My son battled addiction. One person wrote, for 18 years, he was found under a bridge in Phoenix, Arizona. I always thought I would go to your wedding, one person writes. My little sister, I never thought I would go to your funeral. The storms that broke you continue to leave that destruction. And it just goes on and on, and you keep on scrolling and seeing one story after another. How does this affect you to see these stories, Jeremiah?
Yeah, in a couple of ways. I mean, I think, you know, every now and then I just have to take a couple of days away from it, because it is overwhelming when you just kind of look at the emotional side of things. But at the same time, I've heard, you know, a lot of these people have reached out directly, and you know, they found it a great place to kind of share stories and, you know, feel not alone. And it's, you know, it's a place to feel like their loved one is, you know, still being memorialized.
And when we think about the opioid addiction epidemic and the people we've lost, I often think about the people themselves who died. Your project obviously talks about them, but it makes me think about people like you and everyone else who suffered too, siblings and parents and children in some cases, memorializing their parents on the site. So many more people have been affected than the numbers might lead us to think.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, like myself and my family and all the other families on there, there definitely is a void. You know, I think that's, I'll never fill, but I'm partially, you know, through this project, and I'm trying to fill a little bit that way. And yeah, it's really overwhelming, especially looking at all the kids, and, you know, there's a whole generation being lost out there without parents.
Jeremiah Lindemann is with us talking about his project, Celebrating Lost Loved Ones. And it's an interactive map where people share the stories and a picture of loved ones lost to the opioid epidemic. Getting back to the data side of things, Jeremiah, and I know this is important to you, you are also hoping we can do a better job of tracking when overdose medications are administered to people. And more police have these things, houses, we're seeing these things more and more. And you sent me an example from West Allis here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you bet. So, you know, I think there's two things that will, you know, grab people's attention is, you know, one, those human elements, but also seeing what happens in your own neighborhood. You know, people pay attention to that. So there's data, like crowdsourced data and the lost loved ones map, but then there's real data, the data that maybe our local governments are handling. I've kind of started this new project with New America to create an opioid mapping initiative to bring together these local governments that are mapping this, but also, you know, exposing it. So West Allis, their IT, their GIS folks, we're working with their fire department to essentially do things like map where deaths are happening, where they're administering naloxone. Ask any person on a fire department or a cop how their job has changed over the last 5 years, and their job has changed a lot. So by governments visualizing this, one, it puts transparency out there. It shows the work that they're doing, but it also helps these local advocacy groups see, you know, we need to promote awareness efforts in these areas, and it all just kind of ties back into that understanding.
And yeah, I talked to a firefighter retired now from the Wausau area about what the job was like in the last few years compared to the rest of his career, and more of his time and calls were administering naloxone. And way higher as a percentage than it would have been in the past. So by having this information out, both the memorials and the data and these map visualizations, what are you hoping people take away from this to do to start turning the tide?
Well, so like I said, I think there's still so many people that we can talk to that don't really understand. They don't understand that, you know, prescriptions can so easily lead to heroin. And that awareness is instrumental. I think everyone across the country has to understand that. We have to break stigma. We have to, you know, people are saying, oh, people just made a choice or they deserve to die because they did drugs. That's just a bucket of hate that we need to really erase. We need to understand why this problem happens. So awareness happens first. and then addressing with real data, then that's going to help us to make better decisions. So helping these police and fire departments run more efficiently by planning out their resources, helping these local advocacy groups stand up as to where and when they should be promoting activities, that's going to really help, you know, get on the front lines of the epidemic.
One thing I mean, it was hard to read a lot of these stories, but one sign of hope I saw was that a common theme of the people posting on the memorial was that many of them are working on this issue now. One person who lost a brother who was a sergeant in the U.S. Army called on people to pray for families going through this. Others said, hey, I've started to speak out about this, to become an advocate on this issue. Are people like you, Jeremiah, who have lost people to the opioid addiction, kind of on the front lines now and trying to turn things around?
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I probably started this about 3 years ago. I think that's maybe when I came out of my shell. And I want to say maybe about 2 years ago is when it started happening, that I think everyone is starting to come out and realize, you know, they're not, people aren't alone in this. It's exciting because I do think it's going to be more community-based approaches that are going to help, you know, turn this around, and having these, you know, livable communities that are all working together in tandem. So, yeah, I do see that happening a lot. And, you know, I think if people have added someone to the map, they're probably out advocating locally as well.
We'll leave it there for now. Jeremiah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
We've been talking to Jeremiah Lindemann. He's the creator of the online memorial project called Celebrating Lost Loved Ones. It's an interactive map where people share a picture and some words, so sometimes very few, sometimes paragraphs about a loved one they've lost, often to overdose or issues related to opioid addiction. We've got a link to that site on the Central Time Facebook page and at WPR.org. You can go there, see the stories, and I'm sorry if you have a story to share yourself, but you can contribute to Jeremiah's project while you go there. First, as you fire up the grill for a Labor Day cookout, don't just break out the burgers and brats. Instead, how about a nice tuna steak or some shrimp?
If the idea of fish on the grill sounds a little intimidating, don't worry. There are some simple steps you can take to grill fish like a pro.
J.P. Toski is the executive chef at St. Paul Fish Company at the Milwaukee Public Market. J.P., thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you, guys. Hi, Rob. Hi, Veronica. How are you guys doing today?
Really good. And now I grill on a charcoal grill, and I will admit, J.P., I'm a little nervous about buying fish to grill. I'm afraid I'm going to spend that money and then come home and ruin that fish. Why do people like me feel so nervous about seafood?
Well, I think it's a little out of the comfort zone, especially coming from the Midwest. You know, we didn't grow up on it. More of the Friday fish fry kind of vibe, if you know what I mean. But that shouldn't deter people from going outside and giving her a shot. I think one of the biggest things in grilling fish you got to get over is the fear.
The fear factor.
Exactly.
Well, what I envision when I think about doing this, and I actually have been thinking about grilling fish for about 3 weeks now and haven't mustered up the courage, is I envision, you know, $28 gone on fish or something for the family, and then I envision it like flaking down the grill into little ember, charred embers that are inedible. And it seems like this is something that should be best left to the pros, but can us regular guys do it?
No, absolutely. And I think the first step in that would be not setting yourself up for failure, right? So we're going to try and pick the right fish with the right technique that's going to make it so you don't have $28 falling through the grates.
So before we get into particular kinds of fish and other seafood, too, can you give us some 101, some basics that apply to most kinds of seafood grilling?
Well, I think, you know, going from the grill, the number one for all grilling, no matter whether you're grilling pork chops, steaks, or chicken, or seafood, is prep the grates, right? You gotta get them hot, you got to get them clean, and then you got to get them oiled. So, like, what I like to do at home with my Weber is I'll get it up to about 450, 500 degrees constant for a good, like, 5-7 minutes. And then I'll take a nice wire brush and really give it a good work over. And then let it get hot again and do it again. And then give it a nice coating of oil, maybe even two or three if it needs it.
Okay, so you get the grill ready. And you also need to put oil on the fish or maybe like a spray?
Yeah, you could use a pastry brush or a spray, or, you know, at home a lot of times I just use plastic gloves or nylon gloves and a little finger work, you know.
Now, for a lot of marinating of anything, really, I use olive oil. Is that a good choice for my seafood grilling?
I like to stray away from the olive oils. One of my do's on my list for today is use the right oil. So olive oil has a lower burning temperature than a lot of other oils, and since the grill's so hot, it can impart bitter flavors, and it can break down as an oil and not actually let the fish release from the grill. So I like to stick more towards a canola or a vegetable oil. You could certainly finish with some nice extra virgin olive oil as you're finishing the grill process just to give it that flavor. But as your actual grilling oil, I would stick to a higher temp oil, such as canola or vegetable.
Okay, and speaking of temperatures, what kind of temperature should we be cooking our fish at? I'm imagining, fish cooks really fast, it seems like, but I don't know where the sweet spot is.
The golden rule for fish is 8 minutes per 1 inch thick. So, and I like to think of that golden rule occurring around 450 degrees or so grilling temperature, maybe even towards 500. But hotter is usually better. So I usually set my grill for about a medium-high temperature.
We're grilling seafood with J.P. Toski on Food Friday. He's executive chef at the St. Paul Fish Company at the Milwaukee Public Market. Well, let's start with a basic one, J.P., for a first-time fish griller. What's a good fish to grill and a technique to grill it with?
So I like to think of the fish sort of in three categories, just to break it down, because there's so many different kinds, there's so many different flavor profiles and textures, but to just sort of generalize it, I like to think of it in three categories. So we have a light flaky fish, so that's like a sole or a cod or a skate wing, maybe a turbot, and those are really tricky to grill, so we're going to stay away from those, especially just for putting on the grates of the grill. You could certainly go back and play around with foil packets or something like that with those. But then we step into our more medium-bodied fish. So those would be like mahi-mahi, catfish, grouper, salmon. And now we're starting to talk about something that's a little bit more approachable for a novice to put right on the grates and not worry about flaking and falling through. And then to go a step beyond that, we could go into the heavier steaky fishes, which are going to be a lot easier to grill, such as swordfish, marlin, shark, or tuna.
What do you prefer for that very first one? Should we go for one of those heavier fishes?
Yeah, I would suggest maybe like a piece of swordfish or marlin. Tuna is a good one. Salmon would be a good one to start with. Those sort of, like I said, like steakier fishes that are going to really stay together for you. They're not going to flake apart. They can, you know, they can take a little bit more with the spatula going underneath them, and they're not going to flake.
And one tip I keep coming across that's probably not what I would do: don't mess with it so much. I think I would be tempted to like constantly be flipping it and moving it around, and that, I guess, is bad, right?
Absolutely. Well, the more you touch it, the more it's going to flake, right? The more you touch it, the more it has a tendency to fall apart. So you just got to sort of watch it. You can certainly like use a little tip of your spatula to look under, peer under just a little bit to see what kind of color you're getting on the bottom, but people like to just keep working it and working it and working it, and that's gonna make it a little trickier on you.
So I keep hearing about how good salmon is for you, and there are exactly two ways that I like salmon: cedar planked and smoked. And I actually bought a cedar plank, but it's been sitting still in its plastic, actually, in the cupboard. I'd love to use it. Can you explain to me how one actually does that, uses the cedar plank?
Super, super easy. So all you do is soak it prior for about an hour or two in cold water or lukewarm water. You're going to pull it out and then give it a little wipe off to get the excess moisture off. Then take your salmon, whether skin on or skin off, doesn't matter. Give it a nice seasoning of salt and pepper, or maybe some smoked paprika or whatever floats your boat. You know, this time of year people have some nice fresh herbs coming out of the garden, so you could certainly incorporate some of those. And then you're going to put it over indirect heat on your grill, so you'd have one side of your grill at a higher temperature than the other, and you put it on the lower side of the grill, and then lower the top to the grill and let her start smoking away.
And does that kind of steam it a little, the moisture coming up out of the plank?
Well, the moisture is to protect the plank from burning, not so much for the steam aspect, but it will introduce a little bit of water vapor into the atmosphere, which will keep your fish a little less dry.
So you don't have to flip it when it's on the plank then?
Nope. You can just go all the way like that.
That does sound easier.
So that's a really good one for you. Like you said, you had been waiting to grill fish for a couple weeks, and you fret the moment of the $28. So.
Exactly.
But that's a pretty foolproof one for you.
And let's talk a little more about seasoning for fish. Are there seasonings that work well across the fish world, or is it kind of, you know, salmon might want one thing, catfish another?
Certainly you could look at it that way. Everybody's different, and like at St. Paul Fish, one of the ways I look at it is we try really hard. We work really, really hard to get the finest product we can from all sides of the nation. And we don't want to cover it up with too many aggressive flavors. And that's our approach here, is sort of simplicity. But that being said, at home, you know, you are going on the barbecue, so you can get a little bit more bold in flavors. Because if there's one thing that the barbecue does accentuate with fish, it's the acceptance of stronger flavor profiles and seasonings. Where if, like, you're sautéing or baking with fish, you might want to lay off some of, like, the more aggressive seasonings because they won't stand up to the technique.
So one thing when you go out for fish in a restaurant, and it's done really well, probably like at your restaurant, I like it when it gets a nice crust on top. It's almost a little bit crunchy, and then inside it's, you know, it's flaky or whatever. How do you get that kind of crust on the top but still keep it not dry in the middle?
Well, like I said earlier, the first step of that is prepping the grates properly because you're going to get a good sear and it's going to release. So you're not going to leave that crust on the grates when you try to flip it. And then the other part of it is just temping it right on the finish. So, like I said, 8 minutes per 1-inch thick of fish is a really good golden rule to go through. Also, starting at a higher temperature with that nice medium-high temperature is gonna make it so you get a nice crust on the outside.
J.P. Toski is with us. He's executive chef with the St. Paul Fish Company at the Milwaukee Public Market, and he's with us now to share advice about how to grill seafood.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about grilling seafood of any sort? And grillers, what's your favorite type of seafood to put on the grill? What types of fish or shellfish do you think are easiest to grill? What has been a challenge for you? Maybe you have some advice of your own. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up our Food Friday conversation about how to grill seafood this weekend with J.P. Toski, executive chef at St. Paul Fish Company at the Milwaukee Public Market.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about something maybe you want to make this weekend? Do you have a favorite fish or other seafood that you'd like to put on the grill? What advice do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's take a caller now. We've got Joe joining us first in Butler. Joe, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to ask?
I've got some true Lake Superior whitefish somebody's bringing to me. And
nice.
They've done it in the past, baked with like a pesto, and they said, well, you know, try putting it on the grill. I said, I don't want to ruin your whitefish. I'm not going to put it on the grill. Any advice?
Okay, whitefish. I think of that as being flaky. Yeah.
That's something you could certainly do on a cedar plank. I think would be a really good technique for that. I've used that in other restaurants before, using whitefish on a cedar plank. Also, you could try doing it with a foil packet, with not actually encompassing the fish in a foil packet, but just take foil, maybe fold it 3 or 4 pieces over itself, and then put it down on the grill and lay your whitefish down upon that so you know that the whitefish won't fall through, because whitefish is super delicate and you wouldn't want to put that directly on the grates.
All right.
And so turn it, don't turn it. If they want to do the pesto again, when would you put that on?
Well, what I would do is put it on when it's raw. So prep your whitefish, you know, get it all clean and everything, pat it dry, and then put a nice smear of the pesto on it right away, and then put that on top of either your cedar plank or your piece of aluminum foil, and then put that directly on top of the grates.
Joe, good luck. I hope it comes out awesome. We'll go next to Rita in Weyerhaeuser. Rita, hi.
Hi there. I have a question regarding fish baskets. I've heard of people using that technique. So my question is, what kind of fish would you use a fish basket for, and how would you use those? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, I think with a fish basket, I think the idea there is that you're just eliminating the grates. So you're just taking away the grates and putting something a little bit more sturdy under the fish so you don't have to worry about it flaking apart and falling through. That being said, I think you could pretty much use any kind of fish for that technique. It's just a little bit more... It's a little bit more forgiving, let's say, as opposed to going directly onto the grill grates.
So it'd certainly be
a great tool to use.
Is that one of those that closes on both sides, so you can just kind of flip the whole thing?
You know, I've seen them multiple different ways. I know, like, some of the newer charcoal grills and some of the new charbroilers have they have a section of the grates you can actually take out and replace with the grill basket. Mm. So, and then others are secondhand to the grill, so you just put them on top of the grates.
Gotcha. Well, let's go to another phone call. Doug is with us now in Three Lakes. Doug, hi.
Good afternoon. Listen to your program frequently.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks. What can we help you with for fish?
I like salmon. My wife and I have salmon probably once or twice a week. And Copper River salmon is really exceptional.
Well, that's the thing to get right now.
Yes, right.
It's the season.
A little more expensive, but it's worth the effort in a lot of respects. What I do is I put a little olive oil on it and leave it sit. That once it's thawed or if it's fresh, and bring my grill to 500 degrees, lay it on the grill with the skin side up, and I cook it like that for about 90 seconds, and I flip it over because the skin will hold everything firmly together, and just leave it cooked the remainder of the way, and less is more when it comes to time on the grill.
Hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
If it's not done and you take it off, you can always finish it up a little bit, warm it a little more in the microwave. And it should be flaky. It should be less than completely cooked through before you ever take it off, because it is going to...
The residual cooking will definitely keep it going. And I think you're totally on the mark there with salmon especially being something that's okay to serve more like a medium well as opposed to a completely well done. Personally, I like to eat salmon more towards the medium rare side, as long as I know where it was caught and I know it's quality salmon. But that being said, with the skin on, one of the things, there's sort of two schools of thoughts with this. So like you're saying, you sear it on the flesh side really fast and then flip it over to the skin side because you know then you sort of have this protective barrier on the grill and it sort of safeguards you from any kind of mistakes. The other school of thought is that in that skin, there's all these really awesome omega-3 fatty acids and this really nice salmon fat that's going to sort of melt away and marinate the fish. So you'd almost want the fish to be upside down, so gravity self-based the fish as it cooks. So the skin would be on top for the majority of the cooking, and all those salmon fats and all those really nice flavors are going to trickle down over the fish into the grill as it goes, and it'll help self-baste it.
Doug, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to J.P. Toski about grilling fish and other seafood. J.P.'s with the St. Paul Fish Company at the Milwaukee Public Market. And J.P., let's get to the non-fish world here. I understand you love grilling something that I wouldn't have even thought of, oysters.
Oh, absolutely.
Talk about that.
So this is a little bit more towards the expertise area, I guess, of seafood grilling, just because there's a little bit more steps involved. You have to know how to shuck oysters, so that's step one. But one of my favorite things to do is so you take an oyster on the half shell that you've just shucked, hopefully a bunch of them, right, and then make a compound butter. So we'll take like whipped butter, whatever kind of herbs you have laying around, maybe some smoked paprika, some chili flakes, some parsley, and lemon zest, and whip it all together, and then freeze it. And then as the oysters cook on the grill, you just shave a little bit of that off into the cup of each oyster until it bubbles up, and then pull them off. That's a fan favorite in my house.
Oh, that sounds really good. I never would have thought of that. I've had fried oysters, but I haven't had grilled oysters.
It's a nice way for people to get into oysters if they're a little tentative about eating raw ones. We always like to do a party at my house every year where we get a couple cases of oysters, and we'll do a few of them on the grill, and then we'll shuck some of them raw. But it's always sort of funny to watch the people that don't eat a lot of oysters gravitate towards the grilled ones, and then sort of get the flavor profile going, and then look at everybody else eating the raw ones and say, "All right, I'm gonna step up. I'm gonna do this now." And they almost always enjoy it.
And let's get into a treat you hear a lot about a shrimp, the shrimp on the Barbie. We won't share our Australian accent renditions from earlier in the day, but what's the key to making shrimp on the grill, JP?
Well, I think the biggest thing with grilling shrimp is skewer them, right? think about like how many shrimp you're going to have per person if you're cooking for 5 to 6 people, and then how thin your grill grates are and how big your shrimp are. Not only is it a lot of work to keep track of all of them and make sure none of them are burning and keep flipping and flipping and flipping, but also they might fall through. So I always like to skewer my shrimp on a nice big skewer, like a kebab, for instance, and then lay them down on the grill like that. I prefer to grill my shrimp with the shell on, personally, but for a lot of people that's a little much to have to pick the shell off, but I really like the flavor that comes from the shell when you cook it inside of it. But that's sort of to each their own kind of thing.
What about seasoning for shrimp? What do you recommend there?
I like Old Bay a lot, in all honesty. That's one of my favorites for just a really simple flavor profile on shrimp and on lobster tails. Just simple Old Bay with a squeeze of lemon.
I want to get into some side dishes here before we let you go. What do you like to serve with grilled fish and other seafood?
You know, for me, it's really seasonal. I like to take what's in season and sort of work with it. So if we're grilling in the spring, like light arugula and asparagus salads come to mind. If we're going into the heart of summer, then grilled corn or a nice corn salad would be really nice with it. This time of year, we look towards more like autumnal flavors, like squash, pumpkin, things like that.
So you're at the St. Paul Fish Company in the Milwaukee Public Market. How did you get into that and have fish as your specialty?
Well, I started a long time ago as a wee man. I cooked at Heaven City Restaurant in Maquanago for about 7-8 years under my mentor, Chef Scott McGlinchey. And then I went down to Chicago with McCormick and Schmick Seafood Restaurants, where I honed in more on the fish skills, and then came up here back to Milwaukee.
On the Great Lakes, so that's pretty nice. Do you cook a lot of Great Lakes fish?
You know, I like a lot of it. We don't serve any of it here, really, except for a little bit of the whitefish. But the owner of St. Paul Fish does have a boat, and he goes out fishing quite a bit and seems to land a few fish here and there. So we've had our fair share of cohos and kings and lake trouts and fun stuff to work with.
Cool.
And JP, before we let you go, what would you recommend grilling up in the fish world for, say, a Packer game?
Ooh, I would say go shrimp.
Something about
shrimp is a nice finger food for the game. It's sort of tailgatey food, and it's not so much food that you have to plate on a certain, like, for everybody individually. It's more of a group kind of thing.
So with the,
I would go shrimp.
If you're grilling shrimp on the Barbie, just to use the phrase, it's going to take a little tending, right? That's the thing about grilling is you have to stand there. Is there anything that we can do that's a little less fuss for eating seafood, you know, when we don't have time to stand outside and enjoy being in the sun?
Well, you could certainly substitute a lot of these preparations in the oven. Other than that, I think, you know, we're from Wisconsin. We can shovel out whenever we want to and get to our Weber's.
It's true. People do grill in the winter and the slush here in Wisconsin.
Well, JP, thanks a lot for taking the time on what I imagine is a busy Friday afternoon for you.
Oh, we're cranking.
That's J.P. Toski, executive chef at St. Paul Fish Company at the Milwaukee Public Market. He joined us to offer tips for grilling seafood. You're feeling inspired?
I do have this cedar plank, which has been sitting there dying to be used. So, yeah, I think
you didn't
this
salmon
might be
at
the moment.
Same time.
I didn't buy the salmon because that would not be ideal for fresh fish. But, yeah, I might give it a try.
And I am tempted, too. The curse is that people in my family tend to like all different kinds of fish, so it's hard to pick just one kind of fish that's going to make everyone happy, but a little bit of two kinds.
Shrimp smorgasbord at Rob's house.
Not shrimp, I guess, but I guess fish. Yeah.
Fish and seafood.
Like, I have at least one non-crustacean eater in the household who won't even touch it. So,
oysters,
yeah.
Though? Would you try the oysters?
I'll try some more basic fish and then maybe move up from there.
Sounds good. An audience warning. What we are about to say may make you yawn, but not because it's boring.
There's new research out on the science of yawning, in part to answer the question, why are yawns contagious?
Well, there's not quite an answer yet, but researchers at the University of Nottingham are narrowing it down to a part of the brain, the primary motor cortex, which handles a lot of our motor function.
They scanned people's brains while contagious yawns were bouncing around and found that the primary motor cortex, this part of the brain, gets excited when people are echoing each other's yawns. And the more excited this part of the brain is, the more likely you are to have that mirror image yawn.
And this could have some serious benefits. The same part of the brain is related to symptoms of Tourette's syndrome, epilepsy, and autism.
So have you been able to control it? You haven't yawned yet by talking about yawns?
I was actually feeling the urge to yawn as we were talking about it.
And then there's a radio person tip that I believe you told me to, like, kind of get your palate ready.
Yeah.
You fake a yawn. You have a fake yawn. But then, of course, when you do that, sometimes you make other people yawn for reals, and then it bounces back, and pretty soon the show's about to start. We're all yawning. And I always hate when tour groups come by and see us all yawning before we go on.
I don't know if we do that too often, but yeah, it's hard not to yawn even when you fake a yawn. Then you actually yawn.
Central Time. Excuse me. On the Ideas Network.